Madison versus Commonwealth, and then we'll take up all the writs, and after the writs, we'll take a short recess. So, if counsel in the case of Norman Leo Madison versus the Commonwealth, Mr. Powers and Mr. Katz, if you will come forward, please, and give us your argument. Mr. Powers, are you ready to proceed?
I'm ready, Your Honor.
Okay, if you please approach. Do you want any time in rebuttal?
Yes, I would like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Are you familiar with the light system? Once it gets to yellow, you enter your rebuttal time. We'll let you keep talking if you'd like.
I appreciate that. May it please the court, I'm McMillan Powers, and I am here today representing Norman Leo Madison, a very simple, straightforward case of assaulting a law enforcement officer. He was arrested at KFC for public intoxication, but while he was in the holding tank, is alleged to have assaulted an officer by kicking him, resisting the imposition of manacles on his feet and hands. That's the simple facts of the case. Jury, of course, found against my client and determined that he was, in fact, guilty. But the real issue and the reason we're here is because this court has asked us to address the Batson argument, which was raised, namely the strike of four black jurors by the Commonwealth's attorney.
Before we get to the merits, are you satisfied that you've met the requirements under Buck?
Well, Your Honor, that was exactly what the court in the per curiam asked us to do at this point, and I do believe we have. Buck, of course, stands for a couple of propositions. The first and principal proposition that Buck stands for, and I will say it's been cited over 40 times since 1994, and as of this morning, I don't find any new cases, so I'm pretty confident that we're stuck at about 40, just a little over 40. However, 30 of those cases are cited for the general proposition that you cannot raise a new argument on appeal that you didn't present to the trial court. It's the same contemporary objection rule, 5A18 and 525 of the Supreme Court. It's cited 30 times for that simple proposition. And the courts could have cited a number of other Supreme Court cases for the same proposition. However, the 10 cases where it appears in a Batson context are the ones that we want to address. And I think that when you look at the nuance of how those cases have been decided, you will determine that we have procedurally not defaulted and we are able to present a case here on the merits for this court to determine. And so I would like to address the general findings in those five cases, first that come from the Court of Appeals and then the five cases that come from the Supreme Court. Now, the five cases from the Court of Appeals start with Ford and Barnes and Clark. In those cases, there's a filing of a Batson violation, but the trial court did not make a specific finding. And so the Court of Appeals is not going to find a Batson violation where the trial court does not make a specific finding that the explanations given by the Commonwealth's attorney in these cases, the criminal cases, is racially motivated. So first of all, under the general Batson doctrine, you have to prove or have to show that you're in a racial minority and that there is, in fact, a prima facie case made. Once that happens, and it clearly happened in the record here, the court said that. After that, there's an explanation. And then after that, you may have a challenge for pretext. Well, if there's never a finding that they are racially neutral or there's just no finding at all, no statement by the court, this court just doesn't even take those cases. So that's the first three that just really don't apply in this situation. And Pope, the defendant, did not articulate any pretextual motive. But the Commonwealth had, in that particular case, no background whatsoever on the particular juror that was struck. And so the Commonwealth says, we struck them simply because we didn't know anything about them and we just figured they're dangerous. And that's a legitimate reason as far as the court was concerned. Obviously not the case here because they had full information on the background of all the jurors. And then in the Robertson case, and this is really a key one, the court said that you have to show a really good reason if you're going to have a racially neutral strike. It's got to have a real good reason. In the Robertson case, there was a sound reason. The trial was the rape and sodomy of a child. The strike was as to those people who were single and not parents. And the Commonwealth's attorney was clearly looking for a jury made up of parents that he thought would make a jury better composed for convicting on this child rape and sodomy case. Well, we all know that part of the tension of Batson and the whole tension of constructing a jury is, I don't want a fair jury. And no litigator wants a fair jury. I want a jury that will see it my way. Now, there are constitutional restraints, and we cannot get a jury that is constitutionally infirm. And so we have all the safeguards for that. But within those constraints, the Commonwealth's attorney is perfectly allowed to say, I don't want single people on this jury where I have a child who was raped and sodomized. I want parents that will sympathize. And they don't have to articulate that, but that's legitimate.
Well, we're focusing in on this case.
Okay, in this case, the Commonwealth's attorney strikes the first two, Potts and counsel, strikes them because the Commonwealth's attorney says they had family members who were either accused or convicted or somehow caught up in the criminal justice system, even though they said they thought they were treated fairly and they could be good jurors. They were struck nonetheless. The second two jurors that were struck, who were black, were struck for no reason whatsoever, except, as the Commonwealth's attorney said, I just simply struck Whitehead and White because I started at the bottom and went up in reverse order. And as far as I can tell, reverse alphabetical striking is a new concept. And I will say this, clearly on the record, it is benign in its effect, but it is malignant in its effect. And that is the difference, and that goes to the heart of Batson. In the other cases, of course, in cases
I mean,
where the...
Basically, don't the cases say that we defer... Once you get past this sequence, and the trial court is essentially assessing the credibility of the officer of the court before him or her, and their explanation, that that's essentially a factual finding entitled to deference, right? So if there is, in fact, a neutral explanation, which is I just worked my way up from the bottom, that's not racially tinged on the face of it, and the court credits that, then don't we have to defer to at least some degree to a factual finding?
Certainly the burden in the Batson cases is high because I have got to show clear error. I mean, that's the standard. When we get down to the end of it, I've still got to show that Judge Morrison...
It doesn't mean you lose. It just means...
Yeah. Well, that's the burden. And I understand it's way up there. I certainly understand it is a high burden. And I have to show that from the record, Judge Morrison was clearly wrong. Well, that is a hard burden. But we get to that burden and we get to make that burden because... When counsel says that there is no racial explanation here that satisfies the constitutional requirements of due process, you get into other cases, and when you get to the Supreme Court case, and you get to, I believe it's the Jackson case, where you have, it's Chandler, where you have a new argument, which the court doesn't want to hear, which is about the confidence in the jury system and confidence in justice, and says, no, that's just not good enough, and you can't raise a new one. And so we get both prongs of the Buck case. We get the general proposition, plus specifically as applied to Batson. But the point there is that case doesn't bar us because while the confidence in the judicial system is certainly a significant idea, it is not a constitutional guarantee, as is equal protection for a fair and impartial jury guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. So you've got a different standard there, and I just don't think that the cases really go to preclude us from being there.
Counsel, where in the record did you show that with those last two jurors that it was a pretext?
Trial counsel on pages, I believe it's 26 and 27 of the appendix, and I think that they've been probably reviewed in excruciating detail by the Attorney General, as well as by myself. And by the court. I am certain that the court knows those two pages of the record at least as well and better than I. However, at that point, The word, and I will confess, the word pretext does not appear. I do not believe that on constitutional issues that we are bound by a magic word. The objection is made, and it's clear that the objection is made because I don't believe there is a good reason for these strikes. That's why we're having the motion in camera. We're there out of the presence of the jury, and we're having this motion. These are not good strikes. I object to these strikes. Let me hear the explanation. The explanation is that's just not a good enough explanation.
Counsel, let me just stop you there. One of the concerns, obviously, is that the trial court has an opportunity, a full and fair opportunity, to make a decision on jurors. And we might recognize that the magic word pretext does not necessarily have to appear in the record, but doesn't there have to be some sort of argument made by the defendant so that the court can assess whether something is a pretext once the Commonwealth has made its showing of why they struck, he or she struck the jurors?
Let me just address that just for a moment, Judge Decker. In Chandler and in Jackson, these are the Supreme Court cases. In Chandler, the court doesn't specifically address the question that we're talking about, which is procedural default, but it just presumed that there is a preservation of the error and they decide on the merits because of the nature of the constitutional implications of striking the black jurors. Then when you get into Jackson, you have five black jurors that are struck, and once again, the Supreme Court is silent on whether or not there's an actual preservation of the pretext argument. But it seems that simply having five black jurors, and we have four black jurors in this case struck, that raises the awareness of the Supreme Court, at least, enough to where they're going to address the case, hear it on the merits, and make a decision. Now, the jurisprudence, of course, is that consistently the defendant has lost on Batson arguments, but that's not really the issue here. The issue is, can we get to the merit issue? And I believe we can, because I don't believe that the Batson line of cases, as followed by Buck in this Commonwealth, preclude us simply because a magic word isn't spoken. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Certainly, you may.
Thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Katz?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. I'd like to begin today by correcting an error in the Commonwealth's brief. On pages 8 and 9 of the Commonwealth's brief, I make reference to cases cited by the defendant that I suggest are not instructive to the resolution of this matter, and erroneously listed among them is Pope. And certainly Pope is a case of some import for this matter. That's 60 Virginia Appellate 486 from 2012. And it's precisely the manner of case that applies Buck to these circumstances, so to suggest that it's not instructive would be wrong, and I regret any confusion in that regard. And the Supreme Court's opinion in Townsend and this Court's opinion in Pope demonstrate a very straightforward application of the contemporaneous objection requirement, and Pope specifically shows it in the context of a Batson challenge. And there isn't a special rule that's applicable because it's a constitutional issue. It's simply, Judge Decker, as you suggest, it affords the trial court an opportunity to meaningfully rule on the issue before it, and that's what was lacking in this case. To the extent that the defendant suggests...
The arguments and the evidence, it's not really evidence, it's an avowal of counsel, but might be different depending on what phase of a Batson challenge we find ourselves in.
Absolutely, and I think this record demonstrates that. Counsel points to, on page 25 of the Joint Appendix, the initial observation by the defense that none of these members of the veneer who've been struck would seem to have given any difficulty to hearing the case. And that comment is made at the point of the Batson challenge where they're trying to demonstrate that they were struck for a prejudicial purpose. That's not an observation that's made in response to the race-neutral justification. And I don't think you can look at the record at that point and view it as a response to the justification that's offered, that's prior in time. And as you suggest, Judge McCullough, that would make a difference to the trial court. Had the same comment been uttered later in time, then you could understand it as a challenge to the neutral reason given. And that was not the case here. The record is silent as to any response.
I mean, for example, the prosecutor might jump in and say, well, in the last five cases where we had jury trials, and I had jurors I didn't know what to do with, and I had leftover strikes, this is the method I employed. Or conversely, defense counsel might, or the judge might say, in my experience, that's never been done. And so then you would have the development of a record based on specific arguments of counsel.
Absolutely. And here the record is devoid of any of that. We have what can only be assumed as an acquiescence by the trial court in the face of an explanation given by the Commonwealth without objection. It's the stated reason goes unimpeached by the defense. And it would be impossible for this court to then impose its judgment from the cold record, not having heard the explanation given by the Commonwealth. And it is the very reason why deference ought to be given in these circumstances. I would suggest that this is a straightforward application of the contemporaneous objection. There is no specific, unique application of it in this setting. Buck and its progeny do control. And moreover, looking at the record the trial court faced, having been given a neutral explanation and no argument to suggest that it was pretextual, the decision to deny the Batson challenge cannot be determined clearly erroneous. And I would ask the court to affirm. I'm happy to answer any questions the panel may have.
Judge McCullough, do you have any additional questions? Judge Decker? And I have none. Thank you, Mr. Katz.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Powers, you have a few moments left to help us out.
I appreciate the candor of the Attorney General in this. I was a little confused because myself, but I'm certain that would have been corrected, and I appreciate that. I will say, though, that in regard to the record itself on page 27 of the appendix, where defense counsel does say that the objection is on the record, is clearly put on the record at that point, and says, I think it uses what we would all call less than precise language, note my objection, is clearly a reference to what occurred just prior to that when he raises the issue. And of course, this is a matter of the perspective of whether or not as the Attorney General says, no, that's not in the right time frame. You've got to keep doing it and doing all that. We're past all that. The trial court knew exactly what the objection is. And this is my statement at all times when I'm here before this court and others, that when you're trying the case and the bench is actively engaged and we're going back and forth, we know what's going on. Trial counsel knows. Commonwealth attorney knows. The court reporter knows. Everybody knows what's going on. The court is not unaware of the heart and soul of the objection. It has to do with impermissible racial strikes. That's simple. The court then says, well, we're going to let those two stand, and these two, yeah, okay, that's good. We'll let that reverse alphabetical maneuver stand. Whether or not that is something that the court wants to say is permissible or not permissible, I don't know. But I just don't think that on the record here, you can say that under Jackson and under Pope, that we are defaulted procedurally. Because Jackson is very clear that the court does not specifically state that there's ever any preservation of the pretextual argument. And they nevertheless, the Supreme Court goes and hears the case on its merits because of the number of strikes. And I think that is significant here. If we'd had one strike, it might not have argued quite as well for the defendant. But here you have four strikes, and certainly the last two strikes, there's no rationale. If you're going to say, I just randomly took two people. Well, randomly take two non-black people when I have a black defendant in the well getting ready to be tried by this jury. If you're going to go with total randomness, then use something other than the first initial of their name for the randomness. Let's strike everybody in the age category of 40 to 50. Let's strike everybody that's not married. Let's strike everybody that's unemployed. Let's strike some other characteristic that we have on the information provided us as to who these jurors are. But simply to go to the block and say, these two people are struck and, oops, they were black. Well, how do I explain that? I explain that simply because I've got some alphabetical numeration that helps me out. That is, as I said, benign, clearly benign as we hear it, benign as you read it in the record, but malignant at heart. And that is the point. Equal protection requires that those jurors not be struck for the reason they were struck, simply because they were black.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. We'll come down and greet counsel and thank you personally for your argument and then take up the writ docket.